That's off now.
All right, I just wanted to see if this is recording. And it looks fine. From time to time, I may just listen just to make sure, because this is monitoring the tape, not anything else. Well, then, why don't we begin?
All right.
Let me indicate for the record that today is June 20th, 2005. Mm-hmm. Jim Boning speaking with Roy Neville at his home in Pebble Beach, California. Dr. Neville, I know that you were born on October 15th, 1926 in Bournemouth, England.
It's pronounced Bournemouth.
Bournemouth. Okay. I knew I was going to get that wrong, but I appreciate your correcting me.
Yes.
Bournemouth. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, my father came from a very distinguished family, the Neville family. It goes back to Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, who was killed in the Wars of the Roses in 1471. And the Neville name came over, it goes actually back to year, as far as I can trace, to approximately year 700. And I know that Ralph de Neuvy was William the Conqueror's admiral in 1066 when he invaded from Normandy to Hastings in England, the Battle of Hastings. And of course, there's been many, many Nevilles and a very big second history and so on. And Richard Neville was Earl of Warwick, and he ran afoul of Henry IV. And when he was killed at the Battle of Barnet in 1471, his wife, Anne Neville, married Richard III, Richard Crouchback. Now he's a hunchback, supposedly, according to Shakespeare. Anyway, and of course the Neville family was promptly disinherited for disagreeing with Henry IV. And this, by the way, was contrary to Magna Carta. It said that none of the barons can be disinherited from their baronies by the king. But, you know, it's happened and nobody's tried to rectify it. But and so I come down through that long line, and eventually, as you say, my mother was born in London in a place called Chiswick.
Her name?
Her name was Georgina Lally Jenkins. And her mother was a very famous pianist. And her mother, in other words, my great-grandmother, was a celebrated harpist who played at the Royal Albert Hall in front of what they used to term the crown heads of Europe, including Queen Victoria and King Edward VII. And so my mother was always very happy to tell me about that and very proud to tell me about that. They lived in a huge house in London, which unfortunately no longer exists because Kaiser Wilhelm, set on the Zeppelins, and the place was blown to bits in the First World War. Well, my mother's family moved down to Bournemouth, and it was during that period that my mother met my father when he was walking along the promenade. It was on a sort of a winter's day, and her and her sister, Madge, decided to throw some snowballs at the boys. And my mother was just about, I think, 18 at the time. And so, you know, kids, they struck up a conversation, and anyway, my mother said that my father had these beautiful blue eyes. He was blonde and blue-eyed. I was born blonde. I'm not blonde anymore. And my mother had beautiful dark brown, almost black hair. She had brown eyes. So the consequence is I had green eyes. So anyway, they started a date, and 3 years later they got married. And 3 years after that, I was born. So what do you need to know what my father did? Or?
Yes.
Well, my father started out in the grocery trade. He did not have a formal education. He left when he was basically elementary school, like so many people did in those days. And he made his way in a grocery trade and eventually ended up managing a huge grocery store, kind of like the Safeway of the times. But he left that and he joined a wholesale grocery firm and became a salesman in a little van going around servicing other grocers and so on. And then he graduated after perhaps say 20 years to be manager of a local depot in Bournemouth. And from that he built that up to three counties, the counties of Hampshire, Dorset and Wiltshire, which is north of Hampshire and Dorset. And that's where that's when basically he left, I think it was with the firm about 28 years. Well, I was born, as I say, in October of 1926, had a rather horrendous birth. I started to be born around 6 o'clock on a Tuesday evening. And my mother tells me that she was sitting down to have a boiled egg and a piece of bread and butter, you know, and suddenly I was on my way. Her sister was there at the time in Bournemouth, and so in those days they very often didn't, like, people were born at home in those days, and so she was squired upstairs and I was on my way. Well, during the course of being born, I got stuck. And as I understand it from my mother, one arm was out, my head was out, but the rest of me was still inside. So we had this Irish doctor, Dr. McKinney, who was a bit of a lush. We didn't know that at the time. But he came around and tried to do something. And couldn't do anything for about a day and a half, so another person was called in. And he couldn't do anything. So finally, my mother was, I won't say dying, but not too far from it. And she described my face as being kind of a bright reddish-purple. And anyway, a Dr. Vernon came in, a really good man, and delivered me at 11:30 on Friday the 15th. So from Tuesday evening to Friday, I was sort of stuck. Not born and not born. Anyway, because I suppose of this situation, I was, after 6 months, my mother told me I was below my birth weight. And so anyway, they did everything they possibly could. I almost died. My grandfather used to say, well, he used to pass by, he lived on the next street over. He'd say, well, I passed by your place just to see if the blinds were drawn, you know. He was always a very cheerful Charlie. But he's a nice old man, but I mean, at the time it was very serious. Anyway, we had a nurse there. I don't remember her name. My mother told me, but I completely forgot the name. And she said, you've got to sort of get this nourishment into that boy and so on. And so finally, after about a year and a half, I started to be more or less back to normal. And they used to take me up to the village, we lived on the edge of the Bournemouth, sort of like a village, to the greengrocer, and lay me in the place where they weighed out the potatoes, and I was weighed. And, you know, Mum said that it was so wonderful, I put on 2 ounces. You know, big deal, but anyway. But I was still way below my birth weight at the time. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was very, very skinny and short because of the I couldn't eat very much. My mother used to plead with me to eat half a slice of bread. She'd say, well, please do it for Mum. I eat one or two more bites, and I'd say, I'm full, I can't do it, and I would literally perk up. I mean, well, it turned out I had pyloric stenosis. My stomach hadn't probably opened. And so I was enrolled in school, St. James's School in Pokestown, that's the name of the little village on the edge of Bournemouth. And I remember coming home one day, and my mother used to have, we used to have this big old range. And she would always have this toast, you know, on the end of a toasting fork, and she put this strawberry jam on, butter and strawberry jam, and I would eat about barely able to get through one slice of toast and jam, bread and butter and jam. And one day I came home and I said, you know, I'd like another slice. And so Mom said, oh, you sure you can do that? Yes. I suddenly ate six slices. It was dramatic. And as a result of that, I never looked back. But I was so skinny that when she took me down to the beach, in those days, the swimming trunks were just beginning to come in. You know, little boys had them, men had them, so on. But I had this very old-fashioned costume. He was called baby costume. And, you know, so that my ribs wouldn't show. It looked like a washboard. You see, my mother was so ashamed of it. Not that it was hurtful. Anyway, I gradually grew up and so on. And when I was 8, they moved to a different part of Bournemouth. And we'd been renting up until that time. And that was in 1935. And we bought a little house. It was only a little two-bedroom house. And it was £685, which is peanuts nowadays, but that's what it cost in those days. And my father put £25 down. And because you remember, in Britain, you people over here had a terrible depression. We also had a terrible depression.
I was going to ask you if the depression had an effect there as well.
Oh, it was terrible. It was awful. And I can remember, I started off in this new school. And as usual, it was boys, and it was an all-boys school. And the other place, it was mixed infants, you know, girls and boys together. This is my first introduction to an all-boys school. And of course, being fairly little and rather frail, the big bullies set on me, and you know, one would hold me and the other one punched me, and I got my usual upbringing of boys, bully boys kind of stuff. And I used to delight in punching in the stomach, which didn't help at all. But anyway, I remember I lost my temper once, and one of these boys was laying away from me, and I hit him. His name was Fred Hector. And I knocked him over, and he hit his head on the curbstone and lay there. For a moment, I thought, oh my God, I killed him. So, of course, he soon recovered. He was sort of momentarily stunned. And he was stunned for two reasons, I think. One, he didn't expect it from this little guy. And secondly, the curbstone shook him up a bit. So anyway, suddenly I had a lot of respect with the boys at that time. So I went out of that school between 1935 until 1939. And I took the examination to get into Bournemouth School, which is Bournemouth School for Boys, which is a very elite school. Because normally, had I stayed on at the Winton and Morgan School, I would have left. In those days, the leaving age was 14. And I would have been put out as an apprentice to a trade, whatever that might have been. The only thing I was any good at in those days was woodwork and basically playing about in the garden. I mean, hardly a thing to build a career on. So anyway, I went to Bournemouth School and almost from the first lesson, I didn't particularly care for my first lesson in chemistry. It was taught by a fellow called Tubby Sewell. That was his nickname, Tubby, Mr. Sewell. And he was right on the brink of retirement. I should add that the war in Britain or in Europe started September the 3rd, 1939. Hitler marched into Poland September the 1st. We had a pact with Germany at the time, with Poland at the time, that we would go in and help them. So I started September the 19th, 1939. So my whole high school years, all but 1 month, between May and June of 1945, was in the war. Anyway, after Tubby Sewell left, another man took over, and then another one. And somehow or other, I was so intrigued by this little experiment. I mean, it seems laughable now. The difference between a mixture and a compound, very classic experiment. The whole idea was you took a little bit of iron, a little dab of iron filings, a little dab, pinch of sulfur, and mix them together. Then you put dilute sulfuric acid on, and of course you've got hydrogen, and you hold it to a Bunsen flame, and it goes pop. Hydrogen is being evolved in the iron. And then, of course, in another test tube, you heat this mixture, and suddenly incandescence occurs, and you pour, when it's cooled off, you pour dilute sulfuric acid, which what makes more hydrogen sulfide. And I was actually fascinated by this, and I don't know why, but it just sort of fascinated me. I was always interested in what made things work. My father was very mechanical. He used to like to take clocks apart. And I took a clock apart, and I usually had enough left over for another clock. I was very interested not so much in the large scale cogwheel thing. I wanted to know what brass was made of and what things were made on what we were now saying, the atomic and molecular level. My father didn't know anything about it and didn't care. But so I became top of my class in chemistry, in the second form, the third form, the fourth form, the fifth form, the sixth and the upper sixth and so on. And I was literally top of my class throughout, and also top of my class in art. I was very good at art, drawing. I'll come to that later. I believe it was in early 1942, I was then in the early fourth form. I was age, I think, about 15 or so. And I thought it was my patriotic duty to try to find how to make a bomb. And so in those days, the professor or the school teacher brought some of the students who were very, very good at chemistry, including myself, some potassium chloride and barium chloride and red phosphorus. And so I made a beautiful mixture, very carefully, I didn't grind it or anything like that, of barium chloride and red phosphorus, that particular allotrope. And I filled it in a little glass tube and carefully put the lid on it. And I had previously drilled a little hole in it, and I put a piece of magnesium wire in it, which I bought at the local pharmacist. But unfortunately, the magnesium is so corroded, it kept going out, and I had this little spirit lamp, and I completely ignored the fact that underneath all this magnesium oxide on the surface was magnesium. I got down to within about 3 inches of the opening of this mixture in the bottle. Suddenly there was a blinding flash, I've never seen such a flash, and a crack like a crack of doom. My face was about a foot away from this, and there was a huge explosion. It blew up some of the windows in our greenhouse. There was a crater, I later learned, about a foot and a half wide and about a foot deep. And I was blind. I staggered in. I could see my mother was calling to me to come in to dinner. It happened about 7 o'clock in the evening. My father was out on police duty because he was a what they call a special policeman, because most young policemen had been drafted. When I looked at the sky, it was sort of a deep blood red. When I looked everywhere else, it was dark and black. So I managed to grope my way back to the front door and went in. And my mother scolded me and said, "Oh, you naughty boy, what have you done?" And I burned all my hair off, my eyebrows were gone, and my shirt was tattered. And fortunately, because of the force of that explosion, you might think that the glass jar, the little charge would have gone my eye. It was pulverized to dust, practically, fortunately for me. So anyway, I was taken to the doctor next day, and as a matter of fact, we had a doctor right up the street there, and he came down and administered and so on, to keep the boy's eyes covered and so on and so forth. And he put some medication on, and we weren't sure what I'm ever going to see again. Anyway, naturally, I didn't go to school next day, and so I believe it was about 2 days later, he began to make noises to the effect that, "Where's Roy? Roy Neville?" And this wonderful teacher, his name was Dr. Robert E.D. Clark, came around and he pleaded with my parents to let me go on to chemistry. They wanted right there, no more chemistry, none whatever. And my mother wanted me to be an artist, you know, a commercial artist, and posters and anything like that. My father wanted me to be an architect. I was interested in this subject in a sense, but I didn't want to make a career out of it. Anyway, this wonderful teacher, he was a bachelor at the time, and said, well, look, your son, Mrs. Neville, Mr. and Mrs. Neville, could actually, he's so good at chemistry, he could actually go progress and get a university degree. Now, I was so impressed with a university degree because, you know, most of the people we had didn't have degrees. And all the schoolmasters in those time, in that time that I was going to school, all wore their gowns and so on. It was sort of like a mini university. And I knew these teachers had BAs and MAs, and one of them had a PhD and so on. I was extremely impressed. I mean, you know, I was 15. So anyway, he was so nice, Dr. Clark was, he gave us, gave me £2 and said, we'll set him up with a little home laboratory if he will promise never make any more fireworks or anything like that. So he taught me how to diazotize aniline and sulfonic acid and make methyl orange and things of that sort. And that's what I did. I promised faithfully I would never do anything like that again, which I didn't. And so I had my home laboratory. And my father had this tool shed. Well, he moved out of that shed into a smaller shed at the back garden, and so I set my little lab. I remember carving out a piece of wood, a balance, it never worked very well, the two cocoa tin lids and a bit of wire and a razor blade, and try. It was highly inaccurate, but it was better than nothing, I suppose. And I apart from doing experiments in the lab at school, I'd come home and try to do my own. And it was variation of a thing, and what happened if you mix this with that, and so on. I got these pure precipitates, heat the water, and you know, I just love to see the lead iodine, for example, dissolve in the hot water, and then when you cool it, the gorgeous little golden spangles would come down, and I thought, this is absolutely marvelous. I'm going to spell that. Anyway, I went on and got my school certificate. I got basically a distinction in chemistry, a distinction in art, and creditable marks in mathematics and physics and the other subjects that we were required to take.
What year would that have been then?
That was 1943.
43.
And then I went on into the first year six. There is no seventh form. There are the first six and the second six. And I then, of course, at that point, you know, the kids, well, I should say the boys or girls, as the case may be, are usually showing some propensity either towards the arts or towards the sciences. And it's obvious that although I was good at art, I was much better actually at the sciences. So I embarked on chemistry, physics, pure mathematics, and applied mathematics. And I was sort of really good at chemistry. I'm not trying to brag, but I really was. I was always going top. I mean, way top. Like 99s in the next. It was the 70s or 60s. I mean, I never got anything. He used to dot me a point just for my writing. So anyway, let me get away with 100. Anyway, so, but it was nice. So, naturally, I went then for what they used to call the higher school certificate, which if you pass it, you are then ready to go to university. And I got through my high school certificate, fine, and I applied to go to university, and I applied around, and I was awarded a scholarship at Balliol College in Oxford. Now, at that time, I had been deferred. I was 18, and I'd been deferred for 9 months. Well, wouldn't you know it, with my luck, the war ends around, I think, May the 20th of 1945. I took my high school certificate in June of 1945, less than a month later. But because I'd been deferred from military service, so you're supposed to be drafted at 17, I was told by somebody called, the war ended, Churchill was kicked out, the coalition government came to an end, and a Labour government, a socialist government, pretty close to a communist government, got in. And they had an ex-communist minister of education called Ellen Wilkinson. And I remember I was delighted to be accepted for a scholarship. I think they paid £100 at the time to go to Balliol College, Oxford. Also, a town born awarded me what they call the exhibition. scholarship. It's not because I was an exhibitionist, it's because of the Great Exhibition of 1851. In case there's any misunderstanding. But anyway, so I was armed with about 150 pounds to go there, to Oxford. And then in August, I was supposed to go up to Oxford in October. So I had, between June, when I got the scholarship, and October, I had a long summer vacation. Well, I believe it was right about the end of August, I got this letter on His Majesty's service. That was George VI. I'm saying that Mr. Neville, like every other man, young man who's been deferred, must serve 3 years in the military service or industry of national importance. So we appealed to the government. Of course, they were removable. And Ellen Wilkinson was an ex-communist. She'd been in the British Communist Party up until 1923. She was some old spinster, apparently. I looked her up later. And she died in 1947, but anyway. So I was drafted into industry of national importance. So my good friend, Dr. Robert Clark, said, well, I know, and it's ridiculous to go in the army. The war was open, never being demobilized. I said, why send my son into the army to do nothing but square bash, as he put it, and carry a rifle, be shot at by a sergeant? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And then forego going to Oxford. So anyway, I was drafted into industry of national importance. Well, now there was Dr. Clark knew of a Jewish doctor, Dr. Wallersteiner, who had a kind of bombed out factory in Ladbroke Grove, North London, and he got me a job there. Well, I went up there, and my parents bought me some new clothes and so on. I went out there, new shoes, new everything, to a slum in London. I stayed with my auntie Addie, and I had to take four trains there and four trains back in the rush hour, eight trains a day. And when I got there, I was greeted with this literally bombed out and burned out, partly burned out factory. My first assignment was to go in there and clean out these boxes of bottles which had been red hot, but then the fireman's hoses had shivered, so they were. The bottle would look like an intact bottle until you touched it and it all dropped to pieces. And they had had an accident with some paracresol, and there was paracresol all over the floor. Okay.